From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour came during the overnight hours when most of us were sleeping. President Trump was awake, and he was tweeting. And he wrote a tweet that Twitter decided went too far. The tweet, according to Twitter moderators, glorified violence. The president wrote, quote, "These thugs are dishonoring the memory of George Floyd, and I won't let that happen. Just spoke to Minnesota Governor Tim Walz and told him that the military is with him all the way. Any difficulty, and we will assume control, but when the looting starts, the shooting starts. Thank you," end quote. Twitter said it had decided to restrict the tweet based on the historical context of the last line, "When the looting starts, the shooting starts." Twitter only shielded the tweet, allowing users to click through to read it in full if they wanted to. And here's the history, according to the Washington Post. The quote the president tweeted, "When the looting starts, the shooting starts," was said by former Miami Police Chief Walter Headley during a December 1967 news conference. Miami had had a long history of aggressive policing, and the Post said that quote was cited by a national commission as a contributing factor in rioting that broke out in the mostly black Liberty City section of Miami in 1968. But the battle between Trump and Twitter didn't just flare up this morning. This week, the president issued an executive order threatening to narrow legal protections for platforms that censor free speech, that censor speech for ideological reasons. And he made it clear he would seek to punish Facebook, YouTube, other platforms, anyone who interfered with his ability to communicate directly with his followers. His executive order calls for greater scrutiny of social media platforms by limiting or revoking Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. This section goes back to 1996. It's widely viewed as a cornerstone protection for internet use, and if I understand it correctly, it goes like this. If you post horrible things on an internet site, you are responsible, not the operator of that site. President Trump wants to change the rules, and analysts on all sides are warning that if he's successful, it could be a massive blow to free speech and internet freedom. This hour, a conversation not only about this heated issue, but really about how we're getting information. The president thinks he can speak directly to people via Twitter, and he doesn't want any filter for that. He doesn't want journalists in the way. We're going to talk about how we cover and consume news and information going forward. Our guests include the editor of City Newspaper, David Andreotta, who's in studio with me. Nice to have you here. Thanks for coming downstairs.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
Also with us on the line is Helene Biandouti-Hofer, manager of Complicating the Narratives for the Solutions Journalism Network, and our former colleague here. Nice to talk to you. Thanks for being with us, Helene.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
And Mike Johansson, a social media strategist and lecturer of communication at RIT. Mike, welcome to you.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
You know, Mike, before the last 2 days happened, we were going to talk about the future of news and some of these related issues, but it's blown up in 48 hours. And so I will start with you. What do you make of the president's call to repeal Section 230 and his desire to kind of take down any barriers to say what he wants to say to his followers?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, the person that would seem to suffer the most would be him, because if a social media site is no longer just a carrier, but is now a publisher and is liable for everything that's posted, is it likely that they're going to allow him to publish anything? Well, most things he says. I mean, it would seem that's going to hurt him the most. It seems very much cutting off your nose to spite your face. As lots of lawyers have said, and I'm not a lawyer, he doesn't really have the authority to do this. I think it's really a call to Congress to do something about this. And I know there are people there that want to do something about it, but I'm not sure that this is the approach.
Yeah, and Mike, to make sure we're clear on the point that you're making here, when you say this may backfire on him and turn Twitter into a publisher, I think that's actually the category that they would fall into if this actually changed the way the president wants. And if they're a publisher, they could just decide, all right, we're a publisher. You're not getting published. Your account is deleted. So,
right.
I mean, that's as I understand it, yes?
Yes, exactly. And publishers are liable for what they publish. So they're going to be a lot more cautious about what they allow.
So that's an interesting distinction here. Publishers are liable for what they publish, and therefore they're going to exercise a lot more control, whereas now the president or anybody else, any internet troll or whoever, is liable if you write something terrible. And David Andreotta and I were talking in the studio before the program began, and this is where that distinction maybe comes in here. I don't know why he'd want to blur everything together here, but I guess he's trying to take down barriers here.
Yeah, and, I agree that I'm not sure that this executive order would hold up in court if it were ever challenged. But I agree with what Mike says, that it does seem to blur the lines here and create a problem for him. I mean, we've seen a number of cases in which newspapers and speaking as a newspaper editor, a number of cases in which newspapers have been sued for comments that are posted by either anonymous people, mm-hmm. Typically anonymous people, at the bottoms of stories, right? So suddenly, you know, there's a defamatory statement or someone says something about the column or the article that is offensive, and the publishing company, the newspaper in this case, becomes liable for that. And that's been one of the reasons that newspaper companies, including City, have wrestled with the idea of how to monitor comments.
Or delete the comment section entirely.
Exactly. And which City did for some time. We've since reinstalled it, and we're trying to encourage and foster a more civil discourse. So far, it's working, but, you know, it could go off the rails at any moment.
Well, sure. In our second half hour, we're going to talk a lot more about the future of news, not just during the pandemic, but what we're learning about the way people are consuming information. But Helene Biandouti-Hofer is someone who's trying to, I think, look more deeply at news and work with journalists, as you say, to complicate the narratives, to see the deeper angles at play here, to understand better. Are you concerned that not just the president, but political leaders are increasingly trying to say to journalists, we don't need you at all. We're just going to bypass you. We're going to use our channels. We're going to use social media, and we will stop talking to journalists because we can talk directly to the people?
That's a good question, because I'm not sure that I'm concerned that can now happen, because I feel as though to a certain degree that is what has been happening. I think when we look at social media and how it's used, not just by politicians, but by those leading a movement, by those trying to bring about some type of change, they can decide, you know, which specific platform will meet the needs for their particular message. And you know, as a journalist, I have encountered when I haven't been able to get someone to respond to me for a particular conversation that might be a bit difficult, because there is another outlet that they can focus on, and they can get the message out that they want to. So I don't necessarily see this, if I'm understanding your question correctly, as changing that, because mm-hmm. I think to a certain extent that has been happening for quite some time.
Yeah, and so Dave Andreotta, she's right. I mean, we do see political leaders at all different levels of government increasingly saying, I don't need to talk to you. And so what's the pitch as a journalist to why political leaders shouldn't do that? Do you want to make a pitch here?
Well, I understand. I think some of their reasoning is that I don't need my message to be filtered.
Right.
However,
that's right.
But I would make the argument that quality news outlets put the entire story in context, can put the message in context. And some leaders don't want that, of course. They want to just say whatever they want to say. I would argue that if it's put into the proper context, that it lends more credibility, potentially, to a credible argument, and allows for people, the public, to get a better sense of what precisely all the ramifications of the message are.
You're very idealistic.
I have to be, Evan.
I'm mostly kidding. I mean, not totally. I mean, what Dave's saying, I think, is right. But I think, to Helene's point, we've seen a growing list of political leaders feeling like they can circumvent, that they don't have to play by those rules.
I mean, before Donald Trump was president, I seem to recall him, I'm going to paraphrase here, but I seem to recall him saying something to the effect of, you know, having a Twitter account is like owning the New York Times, only better. You don't have to go through the journalists.
Don't make me laugh at this, because it's the future of our industry at stake here. And speaking of understanding that landscape, I want to bring in another guest on the phone. The executive director of the Internet Infrastructure Coalition is Christian Dawson. He is my cousin, but he is not on the show because he's my cousin. He's on the show because he is one of the most qualified people I can find to talk about this. So, Christian, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here. Doing very well. Very well.
So you've already written an op-ed about this. And why don't you briefly kind of remind the audience what the i2 Coalition is, what the mission of your organization is first?
Absolutely. So I represent the kind of companies that create what's called the Internet's infrastructure. We're talking about not the broadband providers that provide you Internet access in your homes, but the people that rack and stack servers and data centers and provide you with the ability to publish content to the website, that basically make it so that there is a whole bunch of publishing functions all over the Internet, and we can have businesses in this environment, especially right now when people are trying to figure out how to digitize their world because they can't go outside and run businesses face-to-face.
And so earlier this hour, Christian, one of our other guests, I think, astutely pointed out that if the president gets his way here, and as he says in all caps this morning, revokes 230 of the Communications Decency Act, that it may blow up in his face here, that he may end up in a situation where Twitter will say, oh, we're a publisher now? Well, we're going to delete your whole account. We're not going to put ourselves at risk for this. But even setting that aside here, let's say he gets his way, and this actually happens. I know you're concerned about sort of the big platforms that we know about, but you've already written that you're concerned about all platforms. Tell me about what worries you the most here.
Well, let me sort of walk back and talk. I want to spend some time talking about the full ramifications of changing 230. And to do that, let me just give you some idea of how sort of deep the scope is. Let's put it in terms that I think the president would understand. Imagine you were running a hotel, right? When you have a hotel, you aren't liable for what people do in their rooms. It's not your job to figure out if what they're doing is illegal. However, you're allowed to employ a code of conduct. You're allowed to say, hey, you're not allowed to run naked in the halls. You're not allowed to have parties until 2 or 3 in the morning. And that is something in the natural, in the real world that feels very natural to us. Section 230 is a bit complicated, but it ultimately gives the same kind of protections in a digital world. The idea is you can simultaneously not be a publisher, and you can maintain a code of conduct and uphold your terms of service without having to be a cop who's chasing down and making sure what everybody's doing everywhere is legal or not legal. You don't have to be the cop who's figuring that out. Now, I know that the intention here is to try and crack down on Twitter and crack down on Facebook. But every internet third party leverages 230 in order to be able to provide services while mitigating their business risk. And what I mean there is, let's take WXXI as an example. I looked online before I came on here, and you guys use a company called Pantheon. It's a small business. Pantheon isn't responsible for what you see on the air. And that is in part because they're protected by 230 to not have to police your content. That's the type of thing that's at risk. And it would set a very different standard than the standard that exists in the real world if we upend it.
So when you say it's at risk, take it to the next step. At risk in what way? Businesses close, small businesses close, internet freedoms and speech is restricted in certain ways, or there's less of sort of an online square for conversation. What happens here?
So now we're talking beyond the scope of the executive order. Now we're saying if we completely upend, get rid of 230, if we get rid of intermediary protections, third-party protections online, and make it so that only those who are willing to police content online are going to be given protections for being able to have content online. Well, you get into a situation where a lot of businesses are simply not going to allow certain types of speech. There's going to be a chilling effect of what is allowed and disallowed. And you're going to get into a situation where only the big survive because they're the only ones with the lawyers on staff in order to figure out how to navigate the never-ending series of lawsuits that'll come.
Does that, editor of City Newspaper, Dave Andrietta, does that make sense to you as a possible outcome, having navigated your own issues dealing with comment sites and liability?
Yeah, it does. I mean, if you take it to the extreme, I think. I'm not sure that it will possibly it could possibly go there. I just think that there are too many small media companies, intermediaries, like Chris describes, that I think would continue to sort of fly under the radar. But yes, I agree with him that if taken to the extreme, that I think that's what we're looking at.
Now, Mike Johansson, let me ask you this, and then I'll turn. I will kind of follow up here because with Christian's point about sort of the big companies surviving here, we've almost seen a jockeying this week between Jack and Mark at Twitter and Facebook to maybe either try to police the president or to show fealty to the president. So Mike Johansson, are you surprised that Mark Zuckerberg kind of showed a little bit more fealty to the White House, saying, look, it's not my job to figure out truth online. I don't feel comfortable doing what Jack Dorsey and Twitter's trying to do. You have any problem with that, Mike?
Well, of course I do. You know I'm a big fan of Facebook.
the least fan of Facebook I know.
Yeah, but I think what you're really hearing here is the voice of Joel Kaplan, who's the Facebook Vice President for Global Public Policy. And he used to work in the Bush White House. He's a very he's a darling of the right, and he's basically sort of a hands-off everything kind of guy. And I think that's the voice you're hearing. And honestly, I think Zuckerberg is going to come around at some point. He will change his attitude. What's amazing to me is that just 2 years ago, their own study found that Facebook is actually a cause for divisiveness in America, and their algorithms are contributing to this. And so he's basically, they ignored that report, and now on top of this, they're going to say, we'll just let anything be published. We won't even vet political ads.
Christian, you want to dissent to that at all? I mean, where do you come down on this one?
Well, I'll tell you what. I'm not an expert when it comes to the specific laws or even the behaviors of social media companies. But I can tell you this, that they do spend a lot of time cutting spam and malware off of their websites, as all of us in the internet's infrastructure do. They spend a lot of time chasing down content that is very disruptive in nature, like, child exploitation material, things like that. And Section 230 is one of the tools that allows them to continue to do that. And so it's another area in which you have to be really careful about getting rid of the tools that shield you from liability when you are in a situation where it could become a real cesspool if we aren't careful.
I want to remind the listeners that part of the reason we're here is what the president has done this week. He has made a call, essentially an executive order, but also continued calls on social media platforms to revoke 230. So when you see revoke 230, he's talking about Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. It goes back to 1996 and widely viewed as a cornerstone protection for internet use and for internet companies. And so if the president has his way, he seems to think what will happen is it will tell Twitter, you just keep everything the same, but you can't police me. That's not really the way most experts view it to happen. And essentially, as much as Christian Dawson, as the executive director of the Internet Infrastructure Coalition, is voicing concern among many other people on all sides of the political spectrum, you can voice this concern, but I also hear analysts saying this is going nowhere. This doesn't have a chance. Do you agree with that, Christian, that this is mostly hot air from the White House, or do you think this could gain velocity?
So I'm out there trying to talk as much as I can about the importance of 230, and I want to make sure that 230, which is under real threat, is given its proper credit for its importance. There is a lot of question as to how enforceable this executive order is and how effective it's going to be. I got to say, there are certain aspects of the executive order that I don't really follow. It doesn't comport with my understanding of how 230 works. But that's something that may end up having to be decided in the court.
Okay, but you take it seriously enough. It sounds like you take it seriously enough anyway.
Well, listen, I mean, coming out of the executive order are going to be studies that are done by the Commerce Department, and I want those studies to take into account an understanding of 230 that's grounded in law. And so we need to speak up and make sure that those studies come out the right way. And legislation will be taken up around 230, and we need to make sure that lawmakers understand how important it is. So I take it very seriously in the context of the overall conversation around the importance of 230. And as far as the strength of the executive order itself, we have to wait and see.
All right, and we're going to turn the conversation in a different direction in our second half hour, which is why I'm going to let Christian go in a minute here. And, you know, the world has enough Dawsons in Rochester, to be honest. However, let me just close with this with you, Christian. I know you're describing a troubling landscape for publishers, and especially if the category of publisher expands, internet platforms, small, medium-sized, large. But what about average, everyday Americans, people who want to communicate the way they want to get news where they want to? How does this impact them?
Well, so in my sort of hellscape view of where 230, where the world could be without 230, you've got an environment in which there's very limited choice because a few big companies that have big pools of lawyers in them are the ones that innovate. We got here to this point where we can, listen, the situation that we're in right now with the pandemic is very difficult, but it's the best time in the world, in the history of the world, for us to be in this situation because of all the technological advancements that we have. And that is innovation that's come from the internet's infrastructure. I want to make sure that the tools that got us that innovation and that small business competitiveness continue. And the situation that people should be concerned about is if you layer on a whole bunch of undue liability and you make small companies, you make everybody responsible for the actions of their users, you're going to get a situation where that innovation evaporates, at least in the United States. That won't be true around the world, but do we want to put America last, so to speak, when it comes to internet innovation? I don't think so.
Thanks for making the time, cousin. Much love, and I really appreciate it. And I know it's a very, very busy time, but we'll check in, and we'll be following this one.
Thanks for having me on.
Christian Dawson is the executive director of the Internet Infrastructure Coalition out of Washington, but really his work is happening here and around the world. And there's a sense now that there is a real threat with the president's call to revoke, repeal, whatever phrase you like, Section 230. So now you're up to speed on 230. And what I want to do in our second half hour is turn the conversation back toward news here, because what the president wants to do is make sure that he's got direct access to voters. You can understand why. I think everybody wants to be able to speak directly to people, but he wants to remove some of the barriers for editing, fact checking, etc. What do people really want? And frankly, what can journalism provide? What are we learning during these hard times about what we can sustain, what people will pay for, what people want to consume, and whether that work's going to change going forward? David Andriotta is the editor of City Newspaper, Helen B. and Duty Hofer, manager of Complicating the Narratives for the Solutions Journalism Network, and Mike Johansson, social media strategist and lecturer of communication at RIT, all on the line with us, and we're right back with them next. Coming up in our second hour, Governor Andrew Cuomo's daily briefing is from New Rochelle, New York today, starts at 1 p.m., and it will preempt our regularly scheduled conversation. The governor, we expect, should have much more to say today about what could happen for Phase 2 in the reopening plan. He's had very little to say all week about it, and today could be the day we see things change. So we're going to try to get some answers, and we'll have that for you next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So let's talk a little bit about how we're consuming news now in this pandemic, and let's ask all of our panelists here if they see that landscape changing temporarily or permanently in any way. David Andriotta, I'll start with you, editor of City Newspaper. You guys are online only right now.
That's right.
And eventually maybe the world goes back to where it was before. But where do you see the world changing in terms of print?
Oh, in terms of print, I mean, I think that I don't think that the daily newspaper is long for this world. And I mean in most markets. I'm talking about the small and regional markets. City has always been a weekly newspaper. We're now functioning more as an online news entity that breaks news daily, has feature stories and whatnot, you know, under the WXXI umbrella. So we're in kind of a holding pattern right now. What happened to City was, with COVID, was that our advertisers dried up, which is going on around the industry, whether you're a daily, a weekly, a monthly,
television,
whatever it is, television, right, everywhere. But we also got hit with a double whammy in that not only did the advertisers dry up, but our points of distribution dried up. So we were a free weekly that you could find in bars, restaurants, cultural institutions, places like that around town that are no longer open. So it became almost cost prohibitive. Not almost, it did become cost prohibitive to continue printing the paper during this time. So we're evaluating that going forward. In terms of, whether people are willing to pay for news, I do see that people are willing to pay for news. There was a long period of time where it was called the democratization of news or the democratization of information, that everything wants to be free on the internet. And I think that there is a faction of the population who is recognizing the importance of paying for quality, curated news. What that kind of pay model looks like going forward is up in the air. Honestly, one of the reasons I came to WXXI is because I appreciated the model with which it is funding its news operations. And that model is membership driven. I think that there's a future for that. I think you're going to see more of that moving forward in smaller and middle-sized markets. I do think that the what I call the big daddies, right, the old gray lady, the New York Times, Washington Post, possibly the Chicago Tribune falls into this category. Yeah, possibly Chicago and L.A. fall into this category. Certainly the Wall Street Journal does. I think they will be able to hold on. And they will have print products going forward for the foreseeable future, but eventually it will go away. And I think that people are willing to pay for that content through that subscription model. I don't think it's working well enough at small and regional news outlets to sustain it going forward, and it's a really, really scary time.
Helen Bianduti Hofer used to be with us at WXXI, and she has been not only a documentarian, a WXXI television host and journalist, has worked at CBS and different platforms, and now as manager of Complicating the Narratives for the Solutions Journalism Network. You made the move pre-pandemic. I'm curious to know how you see things shifting and maybe the role of the kind of work you're trying to do in the future of journalism here.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, as a journalist, not entirely practicing journalism all the time, but working with journalists and training them to kind of sit back and observe what's happening, and not just in terms of talking to journalists, but also learn how they're communicating with the people that they serve and their audiences, and how people in general are kind of thinking about the media and news and coverage. In particular during a time like this. And there are a number of things that I'm seeing. And for one, people want to hear, and it's very evident, and there's the research behind this, people want to hear not just about the problems that are taking place, because we don't have enough bandwidth as human beings to completely consume all of the issues, the problem constantly. They also need and want to understand what's working, right? So yes, with this pandemic, there's just a lot that we don't know yet. But what can we learn from history? What can we learn from how other countries and communities are fighting this and working through this and tackling this that our community can learn from, another community can approach? Like, what are some promising responses in order to work through this and deal with this? And that's kind of a bit of my work with Solutions Journalism Network, but in general, that's just what we're starting to see is that people are, we've got newsrooms around the country and around the world, and they want to know what is working. So there's definitely an appetite for that, and I think what we will see moving forward is more of the shift in terms of how we cover problems. When we just cover the problem, it's almost like a false perception of reality here, because it's almost kind of painting this picture when it's only problem-based that there is no solution, there is no remedy. No one is working to find something for us to, some type of a remedy to an issue. And that's not true. It actually is happening. So I think that we will more and more start to see this concept of solutions journalism, which is rigorous reporting on not just problems but responses to problems, kind of grow and expand, yeah. You know, more than where it is now. The other main thing, if I can quickly, is we've also, I think, recognized, and I think journalists, this is something that we know we're tackling as an industry, but there is this, you know, the reality of is this is a very white, middle class, elite, now the word elite, kind of body, the world of journalism. That's how people identify it. And we are seeing also more and more this disconnect between communities that don't feel as though they're being represented and coverage accurately or coverage at all. This disconnect because of lack of representation in newsrooms, and it's also because we've got equity issues that we have to address too. So I think we are also going to start to see and need to see kind of a reimagining of community as partner and how we connect and meet people where they are and ensure that we are providing for them the type of coverage that they actually want and need. And I think that we're starting to learn that even more at a rapid pace, given what we're going through. And I think that's something that will grow and progress. And I think that's a positive thing that we're going to see come out of this.
All right, before I turn to Mike Johansson, Dave, you want to jump in on that?
Oh, no, I just wanted to touch on what Helen said about that people are hungry for not just the problems, but to find out what is working. And I agree with that. And she sort of touched on it later on in what she just said here. But what I was going to add is that I think people are receptive to problem journalism that highlights problems. I mean, you know, when we do a story that highlights that something is wrong, it seems like to me, I can tell by the readership and by the comments that I see that people seem to be more engaged in that than, you know, a story about the ice cream social that took place down the street. That being said, I do think that Helen is right that people are hungry for what is working, but also when there is a story about problems, they want to hear the solutions with it. I think that's something that has been missing for a long time in journalism.
And I'm very hopeful to hear that. I mean, it makes me hopeful as a journalist. I'll say, I mean, Helen is not only a former colleague here, but a friend of mine, and I took the training with her organization, and it was one of the best trainings I've ever had as a journalist, and I've had a lot. And some of that training you hear employed in just the work that I do in the talk show every day. I agree that there is a thirst for that. I hope people will pay for the content or understand that it's more complex than just saying that's what I want. We have to be willing as consumers to kind of put up or shut up. And Mike Johansson, speaking of that, I mean, in your world, sort of monitoring the social side of things, a lot of people are, they'll tell you, the first place they'll tell you, where do you get your news? Facebook. Where do you get your news? Social media. And Australia announced that Google and Facebook are requiring to pay for news. They're requiring Google and Facebook to pay for news content. Similar moves being floated in France and Germany. Should we see that in the United States, Mike?
Yeah. Throw me the big one. Sure. Well, I absolutely believe there should be some kind of public support. I mean, the foundation of any democracy, obviously, is a well-informed public. How do you get a well-informed public? I don't think it's the way that the latest Pew Research last year discovered that 65%, and that number goes up about 5 to 10% a year, 65% of Americans say that social media is their primary source of news.
Yeah.
And it's mostly people sharing to other people. So just to be clear, what Australia is talking about is when Facebook posts stuff on its own news feed or in Google in its news feed, they would pay for it. But if it's people sharing, I'm not quite sure how they regulate that. So absolutely, I think people should be paying for the content. Someone's got to pay for the journalism. Journalists have to eat, got to keep the lights on. But how that happens, I'm not sure. I would think there could be a system in the United States where one or 2% of the taxes in this country went towards funding publicly supported journalism. I know that would irk some people, but that would be an awful lot of money, and would be helpful to the quality of and breadth of journalism in this country.
Well, to that point about social media, NPR had a piece with this really pleasant headline: "Social media usage is at an all-time high, and that could mean a nightmare for democracy." and I kind of want to ask all three of you about this because here's how I interpret some of what the NPR story is saying about why it can be a nightmare. Instead of a thorough reporting of facts from sources you trust, a David Andreotta, a Gino Finelli, a James Brown, or a solutions-based approach, it's sometimes super high-velocity sharing of stuff, but you don't really know where it's from. And I'll give you an example of the last 24 hours, something that's been sort of driving me nuts. I've seen a lot of people sharing the story out of Florida, which says that in Florida, over the last 5 years, the average number of pneumonia-based deaths, pneumonia-attributed deaths, is X. And this year, it's Y, which is like five times higher, which proves that their COVID deaths are low, but their pneumonia deaths are through the roof, and their pneumonia deaths are never this high, and therefore Florida is cooking the books. But I've only seen this shared from a bunch of people who are not journalists. And so I'm going, is somebody going to step up and address this? I don't really know. And finally, I saw a guy who is a professional researcher. He's an American living in Hong Kong, who dug into the numbers and said, this started on a Reddit thread. Somebody dug up something on pneumonia from one source of Florida data, then COVID from a different source, not realizing that a lot of those deaths are actually the same people. They're actually counted as both. Those aren't different people. And so there may be some, you know, I'm not saying everybody's perfectly clean here, but it was very easy to look at that and say, oh, well, Florida's cooking the books and share it, as opposed to going, what's really all happening here? And yet, Mike Johansson, I saw that pick up crazy velocity in the last 24 hours because I think it confirms people's priors. And to me, that's when it can become a nightmare, when you go, are we really sharing good information, or are we just sharing what makes us feel good? What do you think, Mike?
Well, absolutely. You know, it's one of your favorite phrases, you know, about bias. You know, we tend to sort of read and share and agree with things that we already, you know, seem to know.
Yeah.
I would say the biggest challenge for anyone is that when we go on social media, we tend to dial down the critical thinking, and that's the real problem. You know, the class I teach on critical thinking, one of the exercises is go in and find something that's really popular and dig deep and find out, you know, where are the flaws in what's being said.
Dave Andreotta, what do you make of some of this nightmare?
Yeah, well, you know, one thing that always troubles me about some of these research studies, the one that Mike just, and I'm not familiar totally with what he, with the Pew research study that he cited, where 65% of people say they get their news off of social media, but I've seen things like,
sure,
it, okay?
Yeah.
We've all seen this,
yeah,
stuff. And I feel like when I read these studies, I what concerns me is that they don't drill down deeply enough for me. I don't know if how they're defining news. Are they defining news in this case of this is where people get their primary sources of information about, I don't know, their neighborhood, about what's happening around town? They just hop onto the, you know, Rochester area family's Facebook page and consume that news, or consume that commentary, if you will, and take it as news? Or are they talking about that they get, you know, that they find their stories from the New York Times and the Washington,
right,
Post
and
the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle online?
You're supposed to say city first.
You know what I mean.
You're such a nice person.
Hey, what can I say? It's a paper of record in town. I support it. I know you do,
too. I do, too.
It always leaves me confused. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what those respondents to those research studies are actually referring to when they refer to their news.
It's a good question. My concern is it's a mix, but there's a significant number who is just reading the feeds, not reading the stories or going to the sites of record.
And I actually suspect that's mostly what we're talking about.
Okay, and that's a problem if that's
the case.
It is
a problem.
Yeah, and because, Helene, I can't see a whole lot of solutions-based journalism if we're just, you know, checking our feeds and not going deeper than that, but maybe I'm wrong here. What do you think?
No, that's a good point. And it makes me think of, there's a project called the Trust Project. It was started by a journalist by the name of Sally Lehrman. So basically what they do is they have something called trust indicators, and this is what they vet news articles. So before an article gets published to Facebook, for example, I know Google is a partner, there are certain elements of the article that have to meet all of the trust indicators. So, for example, was a story, you know, locally sourced? How many are there diverse perspectives incorporated? You know, what type of work is it? Certain things. And when that story, which is vetted by a human, meets the trust factors, meaning like this is a story, this is, you know, that you can trust, it's coming from a reliable source, the research, the storyline, the sound bites, et cetera, they have all been vetted. And when it goes to a Facebook, for example, it has, and this is on Facebook, it has a little like icon that says P. So you know that this has been approved mm-hmm. by the project. This is a reliable piece of information that you're getting. So I share that story and what they're doing because it makes me curious about how can we do, is there a way to do something like that that can translate to social media, that can translate to a news feed? So even it's standards like across the board. So when something is posted, this is me, right? I'm the eternal optimist here and believing that we can do something like this. But when someone goes through a news feed and they see an article that has some type of indication that this has been vetted without even going into it, without even like jumping into the piece and just thoroughly reading that framed headline, they know that there's some type of snippet or information there. Yes, they're not going to get into the nuance or the complexity of what the story is about, which they should be doing by clicking and reading more. But even with that, the headline and the three sentence synopsis of what's going on, they know that what they're tuning into or reading, or the video that pops up is actually based on something that's legitimate. And there's truth to what is there. And that's where we get, you know, without that, you know, anything goes. It's like this kind of wild west of stories. And that's where people pick and choose. And that's where, you know, we get into the issue of polarization and division. You know, that's where these things start to crop up because people don't know what's based on fact and not. And then there's so much, you know, issues of trust as it is. But what if we could do something like that? So I think it's just kind of thinking out of the box in terms of how social, you know, we partner with social media giants and tech giants and thinking through these things so that what we're dealing with right now doesn't continue to happen.
Well,
it's possible.
You know, I think what Helen says is really ideal. I'd love to see something like that, some sort of trust indicator on every piece of information that comes through. That would be tremendous if something like that could happen. But I think is that it's incumbent upon all users of social media to recognize what social media is. I've written this in my columns before. I've likened social media, Facebook, Twitter, to like it's really just like a giant bar room, okay? When you go to a bar and you sit next to Joe Schmo at a stool and, you know, maybe you're there on a Saturday afternoon. I used to go with a stack of newspapers and watch whatever baseball game was on TV and have a couple of pints. And you never knew who you were going to sit down next to. And you could have a really fascinating conversation with someone who you felt you could take these stories to the bank. And then every once in a while, you'd come across someone who would be spinning fishtails, and you could recognize it. But, you know, it was just a moment of you're in that moment, you're just entertained, you're either willing to indulge this person or not. That's really what we're seeing on social media. We're just all in a big giant bar room being able to say whatever we want. And the code of conduct that we talked about earlier in the real life bar room, fishtail spinner doesn't fall off his chair or start a fight, he can say whatever he wants.
But we're not as good as I would hope at recognizing the people who are full of it.
But we seem to be in real life. Why not online?
I don't know, because our priors come in. So let me try to...
Well, I can weigh in on that if you like.
I'd love to hear it.
Go ahead, Mike, and then I'm going to try to squeeze in a little bit of listener feedback. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, sure. So one of the basic tenets of communication is we're always looking for cues. When we're talking face-to-face with someone, their body language, what they're doing with their eyes, their eyebrows, their mouth, their nose, their chin, they're all cues as to whether the person is, you know, the veracity of what they're saying. When you're online, you lose all those cues. And I do have a solution for this. It's called the Good Housekeeping Seal of Approval for Journalism. Maybe the Good Journalism Seal of Approval. Ask some big foundation to start it up.
That's an interesting point, though, not being able to see the face. I get you there. Let me get Marie in Fairport on the phone. Go ahead, Marie.
Hi. Let me just say that I've just ordered my first subscription to an online newspaper, the Washington Post, and I did it by mail and paid for it by check, which they didn't like, but they did accept this one time.
They'll still take your money. Okay.
Yes. I can't do it again, but I'm happy for a year. I wondered what Twitter had to win or lose by canceling Trump's, because I think social media is garbage, personally. I do nothing on social media, nothing. But I wondered what they had to win or lose by canceling his access or remaining the status quo.
Yeah, I don't know. Do you have a speculation for that, Dave?
They didn't cancel access.
I think it's the idea that they're willing to take him on head to head here, even if it means, and there's been calls to shut down Mike Johansson. I would say most of the calls I see by political leaders to shut him down, I think Kamala Harris did it during the primaries. I find most of that to be sort of grandstanding. But I don't know what would be gained right now by shutting down the president's feed. I don't see Jack Dorsey saying that's what we want to do. I see him saying we will now fact check or, put warnings on if we think he's glorifying violence, et cetera. And I think there's a difference. What do you think, Mike?
Sure, absolutely. And look, they're a publicly traded company. Donald Trump brings a lot of traffic to them every day. They're not going to get rid of him.
that's a fair point. So the point there, Marie, is I don't think that they're going to shut him down. I think the question is, can they continue to fact check it as they see it? And the president's essentially unhappy and trying to challenge that. John on Twitter tells us that he says what news should try to do to survive is go back to the Cronkite era journalism without agendas being pushed. Imagine if there was a source that you could depend on for just the facts without the breaking news hype. I would buy it and advertise on it. I know John, he's been on the show. He's a really smart guy. I will just say this, John. I think there's a lot of myth around the Cronkite era. Walter Cronkite was a pretty liberal guy. There doesn't exist a human being who is just perfectly unbiased and can filter the truth and is like I would love to think I am the distillation of truth and everybody else is biased. It doesn't. I don't know.
Yeah,
do you see it?
Well, I agree with you. I think that there is a myth around that that era, but also I would argue that I think a lot of people meld different media platforms together and they call them the media. I've been having real problems for a number of years now with Fox News, MSNBC, and CNN, I think, has gone down this road where they they have a news story and then you have it's followed up by 45 minutes of talking heads.
Yeah, right.
And I don't think that's responsible journalism. I don't know if they just don't have enough feet on the ground to report news around the country.
Everything is breaking news, by the way, too.
Correct.
It's a lot of hype. So, and maybe that's what John's talking about, too.
Right. I think that is what John is talking about. Sometimes people will apply that to some large newspapers. But every once in a while, when I find myself in these conversations with the media being skewed, I ask them about their local newspaper. I ask people at their local news. Do you really think that city newspaper, do you really think that WXXI, do you think that the Democrat and Chronicle have these agendas that people are sitting around talking about what we can do to skew aside, to spin something forward or some angle? And usually what I find is typically that their answer is no, but then they come back to, yeah, but CNN, or yeah, the New York Times, or Fox News, or whatever it is. So I guess I understand where John is coming from, but I really hesitate to apply that thinking to smaller operations that are made up of people like you and me who live in this town and just want to report as best they can on the functions of their city government or county government, whatever it may be.
About a minute left. Helene Bandudi-Hofer, what would you say to John in the call to go back to the Cronkite era?
I would say that we're in a different time. And what audience did that work for? I mean, who did that serve well? And did that really serve everyone well? And that's not to negate the strength of that era, but I think in terms of, I think we're right in terms of kind of the mysticism around that. at this day and age, you know, how people receive news and the person delivering it to them and the way in which they choose to, you know, to kind of indulge in it, it's just, it serves different groups in different ways. And so, you know, the one, you know, one group or one demographic may be better served by a different type of coverage. So we have to kind of think about, this kind of goes back to meeting people where they are and providing them the news that they want, and that works for them and that meets a need for their community and helps them, you know, tackle some of the issues that they're specifically dealing with. And that gets, that, you know, is incumbent upon a smaller news outlet that can do that.
Helene is the manager of Complicating the Narratives for the Solutions Journalism Network. Always nice to catch up with you. Thanks for making the time.
You too. Thank you, Evan.
Mike Johansson is the president of the Mark Zuckerberg Fan Club. He's a social media strategist and lecturer of communication at RIT. I know you've got the Zuckerberg poster. Come on.
Yeah. Thanks for the promotion. Yeah.
Always good, Mike. And let's.
Likewise.
Seriously, Mike. One of these days, I want to talk about what's going on in your first country, New Zealand. It's amazing what's happening there. Let's talk about that sometime.
Sure.
Dave Andrietta, editor of City Newspaper, doing such great work, and happy to work with you, sir. Thank you very much.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Evan.
And for listeners curious if the governor's ever going to address Phase 2, we're going to find out in about 90 seconds. His live briefing is coming up.